Hello everyone, my name is Mark Ling and I'm from AmazingSelf.com. Today I've got with me a very special guest. His name is Mark Joiner. Mark Joiner is a number one best-selling author of over a dozen books translated in almost as many languages. He is widely recognized as one of the early pioneers of e-commerce, and he is also widely known for his astute understanding of marketing and, in particular, how human psychology plays its part there. What really excites me about bringing you this interview today is that Mark is a truly inspirational man who has a lot to share with you with regards to how to get what you want out of your life, how to become rich, how to boost your own personal productivity, and how to achieve the mindset that you need to make your dreams come true. Without further ado, I want to introduce you guys to the inspirational, the one and only Mark Joiner. Welcome along, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark.
It's great to have you here. So, Mark, first of all, would you, just for people that don't know about you, would you mind inspiring us all with your amazing background story?
Oh, goodness, I'm wondering where I should begin. Well, in business, I got started while I was in the U.S. Army. I was serving in the military intelligence corps, basically spying on the North Koreans, to put it quite bluntly. And while I was doing that, I just realized that I wanted to get involved in business somehow. I'd always wanted to be involved in business. I had all sorts of little, you know, entrepreneurial activities when I was, you know, quite young. But I'd never really taken it seriously, and I realized at that point I had sort of an opportunity to really blow things up for myself. And what I did was I started playing around with the early internet and some of the pre-internet stuff like bulletin boards, which, you know, I don't know if we need to get into that. Most people won't even know what that is, but it was something that people would dial into directly rather than connect to this wonderful interconnected global network that we're all able to take part in now. And around that time, there weren't any rule books about how to market online simply because it was a brand new thing. We didn't even have secure transactions. And I remembered something that a martial arts teacher taught me. He said that what you learn in the martial arts can be applied metaphorically to any area of your life. And I thought, well, let's really put this to the test. Let's see if it's true. And I started applying that and some things that I knew about basic human psychology just from, you know, my own study and things I'd learned in the military and, you know, varied experiences I'd had throughout my life. And I started formulating my own philosophy of marketing online and talking about that. And I sort of just became, you know, a person that people would go to for advice on the net because I started having some really, you know, great success, you know, right when the net was just really getting the dust kicked off itself. And from there, my business just really blew up. I count myself to be extremely lucky in the way it happened. I think that, you know, part of my success is timing, but also part of it is, you know, as I'm sure we're going to be, you know, talking about tonight, the, you know, the mindset and the attitude and the way of thinking and the way of seeing the world that I adopted for myself. And over time, I closed that early business down in around 2002, and then I, you know, just sat behind the scenes for a while, consulting for people, you know, writing a few books, and you know, a few of which I'm very fortunate to say, you know, have become number one bestsellers since then. And I started a company called Simpleology, which was a personal development program, because the people that were coming to me for marketing advice, you know, at the time, you know, paying me $2,000 an hour, I charge a lot more now. I don't even really do it anymore. But they thought they wanted marketing advice from me. They thought they needed new marketing ideas. And I realized that these guys didn't need any more marketing ideas. They didn't need more marketing advice. What they needed was to sort their lives out because they had so many great ideas. And they had such a great understanding of marketing. They didn't need me to explain that to them any further. So what I ended up doing with a lot of these clients was figuring out how to sort out their day and looking at what was actually going on in their day-to-day behavior and finding out, you know, what are you doing with your time? And most of them were just extremely inefficient with their time. In fact, they were doing very, very little to actually accomplish the goals that they wanted to accomplish. So over time, as you know, I was getting more and more emails asking, you know, for help from people, and I just didn't have the time, or the people couldn't afford to hire me out as a, you know, as a consultant. And I thought I would really love to put together a system for people where anyone around the world could come and access this for free, and I could teach them about 90% of what they need to know to really get their lives sorted out. And that's how Simpleology came around. And that's what has really, that was the key catalyst that's, you know, led me to my current iteration of this business life. And ultimately what we're doing is we're putting all that together, and we're building a conglomerate of companies that are going to be funding a philanthropic research center here in the San Francisco Bay Area where I now live.
Well, you brought up your research center a bit earlier than I'd planned. So, now that you've mentioned it, it would be really great if you could let people know about it. I think for me that was something really inspiring. So I'd like you to just let people know what you're doing there.
Thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about that. And I would just tell people, look, this is going to get slightly technical, you know, for a moment. But the concept is, you know, relatively simple in one sense. What we're going to be doing is developing a class of technology that I call DC3D devices. And what that stands for is dirt cheap decentralized distribution devices. So if you could imagine a small device that you could produce for less than $5 with commonly available materials that anyone could create without being connected to a centralized distribution structure of any sort. And if that device could provide clean water, and then if you have, say, another device that could provide electricity, and another device that could provide internet connectivity, and so on and so forth, so that all of the basic human needs of people would be met through these devices, and none of them were connected to a centralized distribution structure. Now, when people first hear that, they think about it and they think, well, wait a minute, it's interesting, but why? Why would you want to do that? And the ultimate reason why we're doing this is that we feel that it is going to be a technical solution to human conflict. I don't think that human conflict is going to be solved through political means right now. I think that technology has been the thing that has had the greatest impact on the course of history. If you look back at all of the fundamental things that have changed, yes, there are certain political structures that have been more successful than others. I'm a firm believer in democracy and in the structures that we have in countries like New Zealand and the United States and Australia and Canada. I think it's extremely important what we've done there. But if you look at what has had a more profound impact on the world, it comes down to technology. So what I'm saying is, what if we sort of re-engineered the world in a sense so that technology provided for all the basic human needs? I believe that the desire to have conflict with other nations is going to be radically reduced as a result of that, because my theory of conflict is that every bit of conflict that we've had throughout history has been tied into basic human needs in one way or another. You've either got a nation that is threatening its people with a cutoff of basic human needs if they don't fight in a conflict, or you do have another nation somewhere else that's threatening to cut off access to your basic human needs. That if the individuals who were trying to rally to fight conflict can look at the world in an empirical way and say, I have everything I need right here, what you're saying doesn't make any sense at all. It's going to be extremely difficult to rally populations to fight other populations. And then ultimately, the biggest benefit would be that the brain power that we currently have right now, that's tied up in what I call a cycle of slavery in the way society is currently structured, would be freed up so that people could go out and do whatever they want with their time. And I think that there are geniuses out there that are managing McDonald's, and their genius has not been unleashed because they haven't been given an opportunity to nurture and develop it. And that would be another really wonderful side effect of these technologies.
I think it's fantastic what you're doing, and I think it's a truly like noble idea, as well as being something that's like a particularly good idea. But the main reason I wanted you to explain the idea and what you're doing for people is that I just wanted to illustrate a fantastic point here. That you had a great idea, or have a great idea, but you've actually gone ahead and taken consistent action to make that idea happen. And there's, honestly, there are, I believe that the majority of people listening will be able to relate to what I'm saying here, is that there are a lot of people out there that don't do everything they can to chase their dreams. And this is one of your dreams, because I remember you talking to me about this in theory a few years ago, and now it's happening. Mm. And, you know, I think that's fantastic. What do you think people listening to this interview, what would you say to them if you wanted to get them to become the kind of person that actually takes action towards what they do? I mean, how do you adopt that kind of mindset?
That's a really profoundly great question, and I think that your point about there being a difference, sort of a fundamental difference in orientation between people who take action to make things happen and people who sit around passively, I think that that's one of these key differences in life between people who actually, you know, do something for themselves and people who are miserable. And I think that one of the key understandings or distinctions that we need to get is that, you know, we have this word responsibility, right? And it has all of these, you know, negative connotations associated with it. We think, oh man, I have all of these responsibilities weighing me down in my life. And instead, what I advise people to do is to say that, you know, responsibility is not a requirement. Responsibility is a privilege, right? It's actually, it's a golden privilege in our life. Because if you're to look at the opposite of responsibility, I mean, look at the word, right? It means the ability to respond to something. The opposite of responsibility would be imprisonment. It would mean that all of your ability to respond to any particular situation would be taken away. That would be, you know, one key difference. The other one would be what in the clinical psychological world they call two different locuses of control. They make a distinction between an internal and an external locus of control. And somebody who has an external locus of control is constantly looking for events on the outside to explain their lot. They're waiting for people to come in and make things happen for them, or they're looking for places to put blame for why they're feeling miserable or unhappy in any particular moment. Somebody with an internal locus of control would say, I'm not happy right now. I'm going to do something about that. I have the power to make this change in my life. And I think that it's such an extremely important distinction, and I'm shocked at how many people haven't yet made that leap in their life. I talk to people that I used to know in high school, and they're constantly complaining about this situation and that situation, and this person did this to me and that person did that to me, and you know, Obama did this and this, you know, politician did that, and you know, everything is so unfair. And all the while their life is just slipping by while they sit there wasting that time in moments of wallowing in self-pity. They could be going out, getting off their butt and making something happen. And the shift in thinking is so tiny to be able to go from that person who's wallowing in self-pity to being the person who's like, you know what? There's no one in the world who's going to make my life any better. I can either sit here and wallow in that, or I can go out and make the change happen for myself. It is such a tiny shift that it's almost tragic to see people who haven't made that shift yet.
Yeah, I think and another thing about it is sometimes people get overwhelmed when they think about something that they would like to do, and they can't necessarily see the steps in between. But
yes.
I think it's kind of, I don't know, I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, but when you think of a child when they learn to walk, they may not necessarily know exactly how to walk when they get started, but it's all about taking that first step, and then you kind of figure out what to do from your mistakes sometimes as well. How do you see it?
I think that's a great distinction. And I think that, you know, this is the problem, right? Sometimes we go out and we say, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to make things happen. And they take a step and then they fall flat on their face. And they don't realize that this is the lifelong process, right? We've been so trained to think that everything is one and done. Right. We're looking so much for convenience, but we don't realize that very struggle that we have with ourselves in that moment when we fall flat on our face and we decide whether or not to stay down or get back up, that is the struggle. And it's a micro struggle that we face every little day, there's this great video. There's a snippet from a film called Any Given Sunday. And you've got Al Pacino there giving this extremely inspiring speech about, you know, what it means to be a football player. And he says, look, the game of football is about the 6 inches in front of your face, right? And no one is going to fight that fight for you. And it's not about some nebulous idea 1,000 miles down the road. It's about what you're doing right now in this moment. And the more we disconnect ourselves from that, from the reality that when we fall down, even if it's a tiny thing, the act of getting up is the act of becoming a great person in that tiny, tiny act. It's just a matter of turning that into your habitual nature from that point forward.
Right. And, you know, for people listening to this, you know, a goal for you, like a dream, for instance, a dream of many people is to, say, pay their house off. I'm just thinking of, you know, common dreams. Or it might be to lose 20 pounds of weight, or it could be there's a lot of things. I think when it comes to, say, certain dreams, people look at them and they think it's too overwhelming. Like losing 20 pounds might not be as overwhelming as, say, well, it will be for some, but it won't be necessarily as overwhelming as paying off your house when you've got, say, $400,000 to go. And how am I going to pay that off in 5 years if that's your big dream? But I'll get your opinion, because I've got my own sort of thoughts on that. But let's say that was the goal, like something that is quite challenging, like that. What would be the first step just to get things moving for somebody with that kind of goal?
It's a really great question. Well, first of all, we've got to understand that some people respond well to what Jim Collins calls the BHAGs, the big, hairy, audacious goals, right? Some people, however, when they see a BHAG, they look at that and they go, I'll never do that. And it shuts them down, right? So everyone has to understand, you know, a little bit about how they're wired. You know, you've got to figure out, you've got to be a student of yourself and find out to which stimuli do you respond well and to which stimuli do you shut yourself down. Now, in Simpleology, what we do is we help people have a balance of those things. We never like people to look way too far out, because we find that life is just too dynamic and changing to plan, you know, what's going to happen 10 years down the road, right? So, you know, we get people focused on what we call short, medium, and long-term major focuses in their life. But then we have to break these things down into individual steps. Because it's one thing to say, this is something I'm going to do. But until you actually turn it into a plan that you're actually going to execute, or at least know what your next move forward is, it's never going to happen. So it's essential that we look at what that next immediate step is and focus on that and be okay with the fact that, hey, look, we didn't accomplish this entire thing today, but I know that I'm moving my plan forward, because sometimes persistent patience is absolutely essential to accomplish anything of great merit.
Right. And if you, I guess if it was a goal like paying off your house, for instance, in 5 years or whatever the goal might be, perhaps you could, like you say, break that down into a smaller step, like, okay, this is the year that I'm going to make sure that every week I save 10% of my income, and I also learn, like go ahead and learn about business or something like that, or some strategy, so that you actually know that in year two, you're going to be able to take that money that you saved and perhaps start up a small business. Might be an online business if you can't save a lot of money, and that, because online businesses are often cheaper to get underway. Or or if you are able to get the funding, because you might say, right, I want to start a cafe. So you might think, all right, how much money do I need for that? Okay, I can't save all of it, but I'm going to learn how to get a loan from a bank to get that underway, and I'm going to impress them with my business plan for my cafe. So I'm going to know how to – I'm going to learn how to create a good business plan. I'm going to – you know, like there are always ways of doing things. You've just got to chunk it down. I like what you're saying about chunking it down, actually.
Well, what you're saying is a very sensible approach, you know, and I think one really interesting fact that people can use to sort of, you know, understand from a technical and scientific perspective why this type of approach is important. It's that, you know, the human brain has limitations, right? Especially in our conscious memory. There is a study that was performed in Princeton University in the 1970s that resulted in a research paper titled The Magic Number 7 Plus or Minus 2. And to make it quite simple, what they were saying is that the average human brain can only hold between 5 and 9 objects in conscious memory at any one given time, right? So if we don't chunk things down into the simple steps that we can, you know, focus on in any one given moment, we're going to feel overwhelmed. And that's what happens when people look at giant goals and they don't actually break them down. They, you know, their mind starts to go crazy. Oh my God, I'm going to have to do this and I'm going to have to do this. And, you know, before you know it, you've gone to way over 7 things that you're processing in your mind. You've got to get these things out so that your conscious brain isn't forced to do that, because this is a major source of tension. And by the way, that particular phenomenon has other really, you know, profoundly interesting impacts on our life as well, if we want to, you know, get into that at some point.
Yeah, no, I think that carry on if you've got more to say about that, I'd be interested.
Well, it's a bit of a tangent from the point that you were making, but I just want to, you know, take people through a little bit of an exercise that you know they can experience for themselves. And just imagine that you have a personal computer that you're running. It doesn't have to be an IBM PC. It can be a Macintosh or a Linux machine. But you're running one that's a graphic user interface system that has Windows on it, right? And imagine that you open up 5 windows on your machine, and then imagine that you open up another window, and then another window of another program, and then another one, and then another one. Well, we don't have to go too far before the computer starts running quite sluggishly. And the human brain, it turns out, is actually structured in a way that is very similar to the personal computer, in that we have limitations of how much RAM we have, and this is what this research paper was speaking to, how much stuff, how many objects we can have in conscious memory. So another thing that people need to do is that they need to consciously shut down the processes that are running in their minds. Here's how this could play out for people. If you've got things nagging in the back of your mind, like if you've got a conflict with a person that is unresolved, everyone knows that if you have that, you're going to go into the office and you're going to be less effective at work. Why? Because your conscious memory is being burned up by this process that needs to be closed down. Another way it works is people start their day by opening up their email accounts, right? And then you've got the agenda of 1,000 people flooding into your inbox, and it's just extremely overwhelming. So if we don't get a handle on all of these different processes, and we don't understand how to actually manage ourselves as people, it's going to be very difficult for us to pull these things off. And quite sadly, this is why a lot of people fail, is because they don't understand themselves enough to be able to properly manage these different dynamics.
Yeah, I find that interesting, also what you're saying, because I do find people that I might be giving them business coaching, for instance, and I might have an exercise or something that I want them to do for an hour a day. Mm. Problem is they have trouble finding that 1 hour a day because things crop up all the time. For instance, it might be that they're working online on something that I might have given them for an hour. And they might have said that they spent an hour, but actually they got interrupted 6 times with emails that came in.
Yep.
Perhaps during that hour. They may have suddenly had something else catch their eye while they're online.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, they may have a lot of things going on in their head from stuff that's gone on during the day, and that can seriously impact the amount of work that they actually get done in that hour, as opposed to if you happen to have a clear mind, you've only got one thing open on your computer, and that happens to be what you're working on for that hour. It's a big difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, this is one of the clear things that we do in Simpleology, right, is we help people like shut these things down. And, you know, we want them to get in there and know what it is that you want to accomplish in the day, and know what it is, you know, or what behaviors are going to bring you closer to actually accomplishing that. And that simple act of being able to focus on that and identify those things and push everything else out of your periphery has a profound impact on productivity.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. What suggestions also have you got for actually shutting them down, these things? Like, okay, it's obvious you can deal with certain situations like a conflict. Sometimes you can deal with it straight away, but then again, sometimes these things can take a long time, and sometimes you might have some of these people that are listening might have built up a number of things. They might have the lawns to mow. They might have the rubbish to take out. They might have 50 other little tasks to do, errands to run, postcards to send people, or I don't know what. How do you get started?
That's a really great question. And what you just outlined is exactly why a to-do list is probably one of the most toxic management tools ever created, right? Because the to-do list exists without a larger agenda, right? It's just a bunch of stuff. And without actually thinking about what ends up on that list, I mean, it can be anything, and it can be a very, very stifling process. So the Simpleology answer is, you know, part of the free software is we give people this thing called the daily target praxis, and it takes 5 to 15 minutes to run every day. And what it does is it actually forces you to manage that list as such, and you actually consciously ask yourself, okay, is this something I'm going to do today, or is this something I need to think about more? If you think about it more, we push it into something called the mental lockbox. It could be something that you just don't want to do, and we say, okay, dump it. So we've got a little one of the steps in the process is you choose, do it, delegate it, do it, deliberate about it, or dump it, right? If you deliberate about it, we just push it off into the mental lockbox. If you dump it, you just dump it out. If you do it, it means you're actually going to do it today. And then what happens is, and that's, I'm kind of glossing over, there are a few other, you know, steps in the whole process. But then if you have anything left on that list, you go through and you do the DTP the next day, and those items that were undone come up again. And you're forced to evaluate those things again. So rather than, again, having a list that's static, that's going to stay there, constantly being undone, constantly making you feel unsatisfied and unfulfilled, constantly eating up your mental RAM, you're deliberately shutting it down and saying, okay, I'm going to consciously and deliberately decide what it is that I'm going to do. And by the way, we do this all in the context of putting yourself into an area that's conducive of work, right? So that means, you know, shutting off your email, shutting off your phones. And if you have to, set up a different login on your computer, right, where you can't even access your email, where you can't even access those news websites and all those other things that have been distracting you. And maybe, you know, for later we can discuss another topic that, you know, one of the concepts that we teach in our coaching is something I call systems environmental design, which is all about that. It's all about creating an environment that is conducive of the things that you want.
Okay. And just to let people know, the URL for this is simpleologysite.com. That's SimpleologySite. .com, and it's free, the software, so there's no reason why you shouldn't actually go get this and, you know, start taking control back of your life. You'll find, most people find actually that they get more than double the amount of things done every day and lead better lives from using the software, so make sure that you check it out. It's really obvious to me, Mark, that you just could not have achieved everything that you've done without a lot of self-belief and determination, like over and above being really well organized.
Yeah.
And I just want to know, like, where do you think that self-belief and determination comes from? And how would you say that other people can find it within themselves to develop a similar positive belief system about themselves?
You know, it's such a really good question, and it is a process that we all have to go through. And I think that probably the most fundamental thing that I can tell people is that, you know, what you believe isn't necessarily true. And how this factors into your self-belief is that, well, it's like this. Imagine that someone tells you that you are a particular way. Imagine that you're somebody who you know, is a little bit overweight now. or maybe very overweight, but someone told you in your life that you're overweight because you have a glandular problem and that there's nothing you can do about it. Doesn't matter what you eat. Doesn't matter how much exercise. All that stuff is nonsense. It just doesn't work. You're this way. You're never going to change, right? I bet there's someone listening right now, or a bunch of someone's listening right now, who have had the same kind of garbage poured into their head, right? Well, here's the thing. Tell me the crystal ball that that person who said that to was looking into, because I'm sure you're the same, Mark, but my crystal ball is broken. Right? Mine doesn't work. I can't look into the future and say that this is what somebody's fate is, or that this is what someone's nature is. This is how somebody is wired. I don't think even the most astute medical doctor in the world could look at someone and say categorically, this is how you are never going to change. Why? Because everyone changes. In fact, change is not just possible, change is inevitable. You and I are different human beings right now than the human beings we were 30 minutes ago when we started this. Why? Because our neuronal wiring has changed in the last 30 minutes. We've even got different matter in our bodies right now. So the reason I'm saying all this, and it sounds a little bit philosophical, is once you understand that no one can tell you these things categorically, no one is right, no matter how much authority they appear to have, they don't have the right or even the logical ability to tell you that that something is categorically one way or the other. And once you accept that, once you understand that, it becomes really easy to start looking at yourself going, well, wait a minute. If there are no beliefs out there in the world that are categorically true or false, then what can I be? What can I believe about myself to become the person that I want to become? And there are processes that you can go through to actually reinforce those beliefs as well, by the way.
So when you say processes, do you mean things like visualization and like affirmations, or are you talking about something else?
Well, all of those things are good, but I think that by themselves they're flawed. So, and I don't mean to in any way disparage the people who teach any of those things. I think that, I mean, there's so much great stuff that comes out of the personal development world. There's a lot of nonsense too, as you know, and I know you're helping if anything I know about you, I know that you help people distinguish between, you know, what's BS and what's real, which is, you know, one of the reasons I have great respect for you. And, I think that a lot of these different methods are a little bit flawed, and my answer for it is I have a theory that I call Taft Loop Theory. And Taft it's very simple. It just stands for thinking, acting, feeling, and talking. And a loop is probably not the right way of describing it. What it really means is it's a web of things, right? Your thinking affects your acting, which affects your feeling, which affects your talking. And any change on any four of those points is going to affect the other three. And this is why when we attempt to use affirmations, they often really don't work when we use them as a personal development tool by themselves, because we tell ourselves, you know, I'm thin, I'm thin, I'm thin. And then your, you know, very, very rational mind that's looking at empirical evidence says BS, BS, BS. It's not true, right? So to really make the change permanent, we've got to create for ourselves a gestalt approach of a combination of tools that we can craft uniquely for ourselves, by the way, that address all four of those things, the thinking, the acting, the feeling, and the talking. And when we do that, we create a very, very compelling set of changes in ourselves that become synergistic and start to kind of trigger off really positive things. So that when I'm referring to processes, that I would say that the processes can be almost anything, but we have to craft them within the framework of the Taft Loop for them to be really, really effective quickly.
Getting back to what you're saying about no one can tell you what you're going to be and what you're not going to be, I just want to mention something, and you've probably heard of the study before from your study of psychology, but there's a study done on a group of children. In fact, this has been repeated several times in the classroom, where they take a group of children and they get them to sit a sort of like an IQ test. Mm. And they, at the end of it, they tell the children, half of the children, they tell them, you're expected to do very, very well in school and that you've got all this going for you, and we're expecting a lot of things from you. And the other half, they're told that they're average or below average, and the really interesting thing is when they tell the correct people the correct results, you end up getting the same. You end up getting what you expect at the end. Those people become, by the end of them finishing elementary school, they end up getting much higher grades than those that were told that they're not expected to do as well.
Mm.
But the really interesting thing is when you randomly assign who is told that they've got a very good IQ or whatever, and who isn't, you also get the same results. You get the people that, like, you could get a whole bunch of people that did really poorly in the IQ test. You tell them, you know what, you're really smart and you're expected to do very, very well, and we're expecting great things from you. And it's really interesting that those people are the people that do better. It's the people that were told.
It's one of the most profoundly interesting phenomena in psychology, as far as I'm concerned. And it's what you're referring to is what we call the Pygmalion effect. And Pygmalion was a play, I believe, written by Aristophanes. It was some Greek playwright, but then it became a George Bernard Shaw play of the same name, and then the musical My Fair Lady. And it's all, I would encourage anyone to go watch any of those to learn about that. And it's all about exactly that phenomenon. This person takes a young woman who comes from modest means and starts treating her like a lady, and she becomes the lady. And I think that when we see that, I mean, when we understand that that's the case, we want to start treating people better, right? We want to start, having higher expectations of people. But then conversely, we also realize that, man, we've really had a number done on us by a lot of people who have, attempted to keep pigeonholing us into these, low levels of expectation, or who keep, talking to us as if we're less than our full potential.
I think that you've probably heard of this before. If you get a fly or one of those bouncing insects, whatever they're called, sand flies or whatever, you put them, I think it's a grasshopper even, might be the one, I can't remember the exact experiment, but you put it in a cup, in a tall glass, and you cover it up, and it keeps bouncing up and down, and it whacks its head on the top, and you just leave it there for a day. Next day, it bounces up and down, but it never bounces any higher than the top, because even if you take the cover off. And I think that there are a lot of people out there, and I think even to a degree, like, I think all of us are like that, even myself and possibly you, Mark. I don't know enough. I mean, I know you, but I don't know if I can't speak for you, but definitely me. There's always an element of society has placed this lid over our glass, and that may have been your parents, or it may have been other people that have been in your life, to certain things or skill sets, you are that grasshopper in that jar, and you have no idea how high you can go. You can jump right out of that glass and find out that there is a massive world out there of opportunities that you can get into, and you just have no idea that you're still stuck in that glass, and there is no lid on it anymore.
It's such a beautiful metaphor, and there's a very similar thing that we look at from elephant training, right? Young elephants are tethered to the ground, by drilling a stake into the ground and then tethering that to their leg, and the elephants start to struggle and pull against that, and then they give up. And then later on in life, they use the same stake and the same tether, even though here is this giant, majestic creature that could easily yank that stake out of the ground, but because it was trained when it was young that it couldn't pull the stake out of the ground, it stops trying.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's that's a great analogy. I like that one. I'm really hoping that people listening to this start just reconstructing their lives based on what you're hearing here, because there's just so much that you can do with your life that a lot of people don't even realize is even possible, and they would go for it if only they knew. that, I mean, you can really, you can make your dreams come true. I don't necessarily believe it's all hairy-fairy, like, you know, you just believe it's going to happen and it's going to happen, although I do believe that it helps a lot if you have that self-belief, as you can hear from this. But I do believe that you can make, most people can make a lot more happen for themselves in their life. They can make just about any of their major dreams come true if only they were persistent and formed a good plan and basically were well organized and work at it.
I think you're totally right on the money, and I think a really interesting way of looking at it would be this. Imagine that there is some hardwired limitation in what you can actually pull off, right? Now, I don't think any human being knows what that hardwired limitation is going to be for anyone. And by the way, if anyone tells you, I would immediately be suspect of that, right? When somebody tells you, you're never going to do this, or it's impossible for you to do that. BS, they don't know, right? But let's imagine, just, you know, for the sake of the argument, that there was, in fact, some hardwired limitation to the person listening. Let's imagine that your hardwired limitation was that you could only make $500,000 a year. Now, if you set your belief system to be, you know, the $1 million a year guy, you might overshoot that a little bit and get stuck at $500,000. Well, guess what? You're still a lot better off than the guy who's walking around going, man, I'll never make more than $20,000 a year, right? So, I mean, for anyone who has any, you know, logical doubt about that, I would present that argument and say, try pushing your comfort zone. Try raising your belief level up to being somebody that's way beyond what you think you're capable of right now. Try it on for size and see what happens. And the worst that can happen is that you'll be in a better lot than you are now.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important advice. I honestly think, though, that most people, when they try to make more money, they try to get a promotion, or it's amazing. They just solely think about jobs,
right,
rather than taking the time to actually learn how money and wealth is created.
Yes.
I mean, it's amazing that this isn't even taught in school, but gee, if anyone listening here is not in the financial situation that they're in and hasn't educated themselves about money and wealth, then I strongly recommend you take a, you take a look at the money and wealth information that's taught at simpleologysite.com. There's some great stuff there. But B, you can get yourself started by having a look perhaps on Amazon.com at some of the best-selling books on how to get rich.
Mm.
Seriously, if it's got at least 4 stars out of 5 or on Amazon.com, and it's a book on how to be wealthy, it's got good information in it. There's a lot of there's a lot of good books there on that stuff, and it may seem overwhelming at first, but you'll probably find after you've devoured 3, 4, or 5 books, all of a sudden you're going to have a million light bulbs go off in your head, and you're going to start understanding how money is really created, and it's nothing to do with necessarily working by the hour. And that's not to say that you can't make good money that way, but there are other things you can do with your money to make sure that with the money that you make from your job to make sure that in 5 or 10 years time from now, or even less, even sometimes some people might even be far less than that, you can be considerably wealthier than you ever dreamed that you'd be.
Mm. And, you know, there's something to be said about constantly pouring good information like this into your mind. And, you know, like what Mark has developed for you here, you know, the fact that you're going to be getting these messages every month, it's extremely important, because you need to make this a constant process. Why? Because you're constantly exposed to messages to the contrary. If you turn on the TV, you are going to be seeing messages that are the very same messages that put everyone that's putting them into the pit of despair that they've been in all these years. If you want to pull yourself out of that, you've got to expose yourself to different ideas. If you want to be like everyone else, expose yourself to the same information that everyone else is getting. If you want to be a great person, a person who's financially successful or successful in any way at all, or in any field of endeavor, you want to expose yourself to the types of people who are achieving that level of success, and you want to expose yourself to those types of messages. That's why it's extremely important that every month when Mark sends you these, pop these CDs in or listen to them, you know, on your computer, in your car, or wherever, and make it a constant habit, because it's the habitual things that we do in our lives that have the most profound impact on who we become.
Yeah, absolutely. And you may have heard of this before, that a lot of people say that your income, or not even just your income, but your situation, who you are, is pretty much going to be the average of your five best friends. That's what seems to be the case for the majority of people in society. They seem to be about the average of their five best friends in terms of perhaps their weight, in terms of how good they are at sport, how much money they make. It's the majority of people, not everybody, but majority of people, that's pretty much what happens. But then I tend to believe it's not necessarily your five best friends. It's just the five biggest influences. And if you can if you can upgrade who you're being influenced by, you can still have those five best friends, whoever they might be out there. But if you're getting influenced by perhaps people like myself and Mark Joyner, or perhaps by other people, like you might go onto Amazon.com and find some amazing books written by some fantastic authors. Or even if book reading isn't your thing, there's a lot of audio books on there that you can listen to and put in your car, so that when you're driving, rather than perhaps being just listening to music every time, perhaps a third of the time, even, you might just decide, you know what, I'm going to just choose right now to influence my mind with some information from people that have achieved things that I want to achieve in my life.
That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, I do that myself. I mean, I have, a little iPod cradle in my bathroom, for example. This is going to sound really personal and kind of funny, you know, but like, you know, when I wake up in the mornings and after I do my gym routine, whenever I'm in the shower, I reflexively turn something on. There are, you know, a few favorite things that I like to listen to over and over again, for example. You know, in my car, you know, my immediate reaction is I plug in my iPhone. I turn on something to listen to. You know, it drives my wife nuts sometimes. She doesn't want to listen to it as much. I say, too bad, you know, I'm listening to it, right? You know, she starts to get into it. It starts to change her a little bit, you know? So, I mean, you want to surround yourself, and I was talking earlier about designing your environment. You know, part of your environment is the, you know, auditory and visual message environment that you're living in as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then sometimes that can also mean eliminating certain people, or at least reducing their effect on your life. If somebody happens to be a really negative influence, you might just have to hang out with them a lot less, and it can make a big difference.
That's right.
Speaking of, jumping outside the jar, if you're a grasshopper, and making the impossible possible, I thought I would bring up something that you did that really impressed me about a year ago, and it's got nothing to do with making money. I remember you had to make a meeting. You wanted to, like, we'd arranged to have a meeting, and this was in Auckland, New Zealand, that we had this meeting, right? And a few days, and you were telling me, oh man, I have to go to New York though, and go and run in this 20 mile. I think it was 20 miles you had to run, and you had to do it barefoot.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I've already booked my plane tickets, and I said, but I did say that I could rearrange things, but you were like, no, I'm going to make it. You've already booked things, so I'm going to make it. And what Mark did was he flew to New York, and was it the day that you arrived that you ran those 20 miles?
The very next morning. I flew back the same day, though.
Right. So the very next – so he flies to New York from New Zealand. Okay. That's a long way for anyone that doesn't know. You know, we're talking like I don't know how many hours, including 20, airport
20
time.
20 hours, I think, yeah.
Right. So it's a long time. So flying from New Zealand all the way to New York City. The very next morning, he runs barefoot for 20 miles to help raise money for charity. Runs 20 miles barefoot to help support one of his friends that was running a really good fundraiser there. And then he turns around, gets on the plane that night, and flies back to New Zealand for our meeting.
Yep.
makes the impossible. Just someone that isn't told what you can and cannot do. I just thought that was, you know, I mean, it's, I'm sure that there have been more impossible things that have been done, but I don't know if I've heard of too many that were more impressive than that, especially that last year anyway, in my personal experience, that, you know, of people that I actually know. That was, I thought that was mightily impressive. So I thought, well, I'd just bring that up.
I really appreciate you remembering that. In fact, well, it was a half marathon that I ran, and it was through the streets of Manhattan, actually. And we were all kind of picking glass out of our feet at the end of it, but it wasn't as bad as I make it sound. My legs were pretty beat up. But, you know, I have to turn this back around on you. What's interesting is you and I had a meeting with some other mutual friends in Auckland, New Zealand, about a year before that. And you had an obligation to make that meeting, but you had actually just started the recovery of pneumonia. And I think you were actually, you know, in the middle of having pneumonia during those meetings, but you still made the meetings because you promised that you would be there. So I remember that about you.
Right, right. That said, I will not, I would not necessarily say that I would recommend people
right.
with pneumonia that you go to work.
Yep.
Yeah, that may or may not have been a smart thing, but yeah, I did make that meeting, pneumonia and all. And
but it was honorable. It was very honorable.
So, it's quite funny in some ways looking back, because I don't know how often, I think it was every 10 to 15 minutes I was having massive coughing fits and running off and throwing up in the bathroom.
Yeah, and well, so, and you maintained yourself very well throughout the whole process. So, I mean, it's good for people. I was just going to say, it's good for people to recognize that, I mean, you can overcome some very, very difficult things in your life. Sometimes things that you might perceive to be insurmountable. And again, perhaps this is, you know, a callback to what we were saying earlier about belief. You know, you believed that you could overcome that barrier. A lot of people would just say, look, it's impossible to have this meeting when you have pneumonia.
Yeah, totally. Now, you used to be in the United States Army.
Yeah,
right?
Army.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, in the U.S. Army. And from there, you become a majorly well-known business person, and also you've managed to become a best-selling author, New York Times bestseller, and you've become a best-selling author 12 times over, and you've had your books translated and sold in almost as many languages. Now, talking about making the impossible possible, you know, there would have been a time, obviously, before you've written your first bestseller, where if you'd said to somebody, I'm going to become a New York Times bestselling author, if you'd told your army buddies that that's what you're going to do, that people wouldn't have believed you. How did you make this happen?
That's a really good question. Well, first of all, I want to have one tiny correction. I mean, I'm actually in 20 languages now, and which
oh,
is
wow.
really cool.
Okay.
Yeah, and I it's so cool. My publisher just, you know, does these things for me, and it's fantastic. They're John Wiley and Sons, by the way. They're one of the, you know, the big publishing houses there in New York, and they're just, you know, just fantastic. But the way I did it was, you know, it was when I had that epiphany about my life and realizing that, you know, I could become whoever I wanted, and that I just simply needed to shift my belief system a little bit. You know, I always wanted to be a best-selling author, and I said, well, you know, when am I actually going to do this? And I said, well, I mean, I can keep putting this into the future. I can actually do this now. And I think if I keep putting it in the future, it's going to stay in the future, which, by the way, is an extremely important point about goal setting. Whenever we say we're going to do something next month, well, when is next month in relation to next month when you're actually in next month? It's the following month. Right? You need to set like a really specific time. I'm actually going to do this on July 3rd, right? Or something like that. That's why, you know, specifics like that are extremely helpful psychologically. But I had that, you know, that realization, and I said, okay, I'm going to do this by this time. I'm going to orchestrate this campaign, and I'm going to figure out how does one become a bestseller. And I simply deconstructed the process. And I realized that, you know, I could do it on the internet. You know, this was the first time anybody had really done an internet promotion to become a bestseller, you know, which people are doing a little more commonly now. It's kind of like, you know, the Roger Bannister running the 4-minute mile. You know, once it's been done, you know, everybody around the world starts doing it. Now, you know, since I did that, we've got people all over who are following that process, you know, becoming a bestseller by, you know, using a very carefully orchestrated plan. But I guess the main point here is that, you know, I shifted my belief and then I deconstructed the way it had been done before and adapted it to my current situation. And it was as simple as that, really.
Right. I think it's really amazing what you managed to do there. And just letting people know, if you join the free simpleologysite.com, there happens to be a product that Mark created. I think it was I can't remember the exact price now, but it was pretty low from what I could remember, and you guys should check it out, where Mark details specifically how to become a New York Times best-selling author step by step. So if that's something that interests you guys, then you should check that out. Obviously, I can't expect Mark to teach the entire process in the space of like a 5-minute answer to a question, but I thought that was a really good answer, though.
Well, I could give a short summary of that.
That'd be great if you could give a short summary.
Yeah, sure. Well, what I would say is it's really simple. You just have to understand, you know, where you want to become a bestseller, and that's going to be some list somewhere, right? Let's say it's the New York Times bestseller list. Well, you've got to understand how they make that decision. Now, I don't want to use the New York Times as an example because that one is a little subtler than other lists. But let's just say you want to become an Amazon number one bestseller. All you have to do is understand that Amazon is calculating its ratings every hour. So you can, in the course of 1 hour, with enough concerted promotion, hit the top of the Amazon bestseller list. And you will forever, from that day forward, be a number one bestseller. And the way to do that is to orchestrate a campaign of promotion with a lot of other people and to provide, short-term incentives to people for buying the book in that narrow time frame. And that's really all there is to it. Now, obviously, that's a lot of coordination that one has to do, but it doesn't have to be more complicated than that.
Right. So I happen to recall when you were promoting one of your books, a short-term incentive that people got was all the people that were promoting these books were promoting your book, like put a bonus of theirs into your members area. It was a downloadable bonus, so it didn't cost you to distribute the bonus, but it meant that people, when they bought the book, they also got like their choice of dozens of other bonuses that they could get. In fact, some of these people were even willing to post out these bonuses in the mail. So, that was incredible.
That's right. And that's, you know, you've got to really flip your thinking up. When we originally started doing this concept, it was like, you know, it was digital stuff that we'd give away. And then people started doing the same thing. So we had to start trumping it, you know, getting bigger and bigger. And finally we had one, which was all, you know, hey, everyone who's offering a bonus is going to be shipping something to your door. So you're actually going to get like thousands of dollars worth of stuff just for buying this book. That was extremely effective.
Right. And these people were willing to ship these bonuses because they knew that they know the power of the value of leads, because
Yes. If
people want their bonus, then they may, and it's a good bonus, then they may want to buy more stuff from them in the future. And so that was worthwhile to these people.
That's precisely it.
I've just got a couple more questions before we wrap things up, Mark. When it comes to wealthy people and poor people, are there any other mindset things that we haven't covered in this particular call? Like, what are the main differences, perhaps, that we haven't covered between wealthy people and poor people?
I would say there are a lot of subtle ones, but one of the most profoundly obvious ones that, well, at least obvious to you and me, because you and I have broken through this, but is certainly a highly prevalent issue, is the belief that money is evil and that the process of making money is a process of duping people, that the only way to make money is to harm other people or to deceive people. And it's patently false, because money is not good or evil. I mean, that's a value judgment that's really meaningless, that we're putting on a tool that we use. You know, money is only as good or as evil as the purpose to which you use it. And it's also, as an earner of money, that money is only as good or as evil as the process through which you earn that money. And I would say, I would even go so far as to say this: if you make money through providing real positive value for people and through the process of helping people, the amount of money that you have is a measure of the good that you have actually performed in the world. And I think that when people can get their head around that, it's going to break through 1,001 other little subtle things that are going to trip them up and prevent them from actually reaching out and grabbing the money when they can.
Cool. Fantastic. Now, another reason why I've noticed that you've been so successful is that you've got a really astute understanding of actually how to market to people and how to actually make sales and use human psychology to your advantage. Would you mind sharing with me, say, let's say, I'll just ask for three of, because you've got many, and people, if you want to find out more, just check out Mind Control Marketing when you're in the Simpleology site. Mark's got a lot more of this sort of stuff, but I just wanted you to give me three examples, three ways using human psychology to your advantage, perhaps examples from internet marketing and also from mainstream commercial marketing, so that people can get an understanding of what you're talking about, but three ways that you can market to your advantage using human psychology.
That's such a great question. I love the way you phrase that. Before I start getting into that, the psychological side of it, I just want to preface it. You know, the book Mind Control Marketing was, in fact, the first number one bestseller that I had that I used that, you know, promotional methodology for. And I pulled it off the market, and it's now being sold on the Amazon marketplace for like $2,000 a copy and up. And sometimes you'll see it for around $500, but it's because it's out of print. And the reason I let it go out of print was because, you know, I was starting to get a little bit concerned that people could abuse these types of you know, approaches. So I just want to preface this before I teach, you know, three of these psychological principles that are taught in Mind Control Marketing. I want everyone to understand that really the only valid way to make money long term is through an exchange of value through people. And when we start with Mind Control Marketing as the framework, you know, we forget that, you know, they're paying us for an exchange of value that we're giving them. And this was, you know, a point of one of my later books, The Irresistible Offer, which was all about saying, look, you need to make that quid pro quo, that exchange with the person with whom you're doing business, something that's very, very beneficial for them. So with that said, and I just want to make sure that everyone listening, when you use the psychology, use that type of grounding, because that I think is a very important ethical framework from which to start. So the first principle that I would want to point out is a very, very easy principle to understand, and one of the most profoundly powerful principles of psychology is something called the Zeigarnik effect. And it was a principle that was first observed by a cognitive psychologist by the name of Bluma Zeigarnik. And Zeigarnik was looking at the behavior of waiters in restaurants. And she noticed that waiters were able to remember very, very lengthy orders up until the point that the order was delivered. After the order was delivered, the order would just completely leave their minds. They would forget the order completely. They wouldn't remember a single detail about it. And what this means is that when things are incomplete, the human brain seems to be in a state of disequilibrium, and it wants to get back to homeostasis. What that really means is that the brain is uncomfortable when things are incomplete. So much so that the incompleteness can actually heighten our memory. It can heighten our awareness. It can heighten our senses. In marketing, we use it like this. We want to use what I call nested Zeigarnik hooks in our marketing. You know, present something to someone that is incomplete, the completeness of which will only be satisfied by getting deeper and deeper into your marketing message, and then ultimately only be satisfied by buying your product or service. And once you start to look around and you see this, you'll notice that it's everywhere. For example, the TV show Lost was perhaps one of the longest running examples of the manipulation of the human consciousness through the Zeigarnik effect ever, right? In fact, I don't think they ever really answered all the questions in Lost, but everybody kept watching this thing for 7 years, right? And why? Only because it was incomplete. And in fact, I would have people come to me complaining about Lost. I'm getting so sick of Lost, but darn it, I need to find out what these guys are actually doing, what this island is actually all about. That's how powerful the Zeigarnik effect is. You can change someone's behavior for a course of 7 years through the Zeigarnik effect. Do you want to talk about that some more? Should we move on to example number two?
I might just give one, perhaps just get one other quick example of the Zagarnik effect, perhaps. That was great from real life, and perhaps just one from, say, an internet marketing perspective.
Well, in emails, what I like to do is I like to make the email itself incomplete. You know, like I'll do things like this. I'll have a subject line that would say something like, "This is crazy," right? And then the email would read something like, you know, "This is the craziest method I've ever seen anyone use, you know, for driving traffic to their website. I wouldn't have believed that it could work until he showed me his famous, you know, blardy blah formula," or something like that, right? Now, you don't know what this crazy method is. You don't know what the blardy blah formula is. But, man, you really want to click on that link, partly because you want an answer to that question. Now, notice also that the Zagarnik effect was intensified by the fact that we made it very personal and of interest to somebody who's reading that email. Like, if this is an email that's sent out to somebody who's interested in marketing, then, you know, I've put in there, I said, well, this is, you know, we're talking about a traffic building technique here. So if I had just said, "Hey, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen," you know, you may want to click on that link. But if I say this is the craziest traffic building method I've ever seen, and then I kind of make it a little more concrete by saying it's the blardy blah method or whatever it is, then the Zagarnik effect is intensified. Now, that will get the click rates of your emails to absolutely skyrocket when you use that kind of method.
Cool. I'll let you carry on with the other couple of methods. This is great.
Cool. The next one would be conformity to emotions. And conformity to emotions is a really fascinating psychological phenomenon. And what it states is that we tend to conform to the emotional state of those around us. Now, this was corroborated by a really fascinating study. A group of people were given ephedrine, and they had plants inside these little test chambers of people who were actors. Now, in the field of psychological research, they call them confederates, right? So the confederates know that they're in on the psychological experiment, and you give them some special instructions. So they take a group of guys, they give them ephedrine, and ephedrine, by the way, just makes you feel a little bit amped up, right? It doesn't make you feel necessarily good or necessarily bad. It just makes you feel kind of like really, you know, sort of excited, right? And in some groups, they would say, okay, all of the confederates, we want you to act really, really bummed out. And they would start freaking out and saying things like, "Man, this drug is really making me uncomfortable. I really feel bad. You know, this is awful. I want this to end." And then all of the test candidates would start to mirror that emotion. They would be like, "Yeah, I feel really bad too." Then they would take other groups where they would have the confederates go in the room and they would say, "Wow, this drug is awesome. I feel amazing. Right? This is the best thing ever." And then the test candidates would be like, "Yeah, I feel great too. Man, this is awesome." And what this illustrated was that the subjective experience of these people could be greatly altered by the subjective experience as expressed by the people around them. And this is a profoundly important discovery, because when we inadvertently put in, you know, negative associations or negative emotion into our marketing, well, people are going to start to associate that negative emotion with the product. This is why when you see the great branding campaigns of companies like Coke and McDonald's, you see lots of happy faces in the advertising, because they know that it's been proven categorically that this works extremely well in getting people to associate positive, happy emotions with your product. And this can measurably translate into people buying more of your stuff.
Yeah, that makes great sense. So in a so you're saying, like, in a internet marketing sense, or in a even in an offline sense, having a lot of photos of happy customers to show people. I guess if you're a real estate agent, you could easily, and you're trying to get a client in order to sell their house, you could. I guess one thing you could present to them is not only a list of testimonials inside, say, your folder or something, but you have a lot of happy-faced photos of people with standing right outside their house.
Absolutely.
That's just been sold.
Yep, no question.
Right. No, it makes great sense. And I guess people selling products on websites, you have lots of success stories from happy customers with their, you know, happy smiley face photos next to them.
Absolutely.
All right, and I'll get on to the third one.
All right, so the third one I would bring up, and by the way, this is just, you know, three from a, you know, collection of about, you know, 30 or so, you know, psychological and military principles, you know, that are outlined in the book. You know, that I think are a little bit dangerous, some of them. I mean, you can see how this information can be used, you know, in the wrong way, right? This is what was my trepidation, you know, in, you know, really popularizing the ideas. But another one, that's extremely powerful is, known as the conform or the, obedience to authority. And I have a rather, shocking and slightly disturbing, I shouldn't even say slightly disturbing, extremely disturbing example to give people. So I would just say, if you're slightly squeamish, or if your faith in humanity is ever questioned, I would say maybe pause this recording because it's pretty heavy. But it's also something that can open up some really profoundly powerful things in people's minds. And it works like this. Stanley Milgram is the gentleman who came up with that phrase, and he was another cognitive psychologist, and he conducted one of the most famous experiments in the history of psychology. And he would take the test candidate and put them in a room that had a series of dials in front of them, or buttons, right? And the buttons were labeled 1 to 10, and then X, XX, and then triple X. And inside, or on the other side of a sheet of glass, was the Confederate. Now, the Confederate was told to act, you know, based on the number that was pushed. Now, these buttons were reported to the test candidate to administer electrical shocks. Now, they weren't actually administering electrical shocks, right? The Confederate was told, hey, when he pushes button one, you know, react mildly. But then when he gets to you know, X or double X or triple X, you want to be in so much pain that you're actually going to pretend like it just killed you. Right. And a very authoritative looking person who was usually like a graduate student, you know, would come into the room with a test candidate with a smock on, and, you know, with a, you know, rather official looking badge, and, you know, a stethoscope and a, you know, a clipboard and a pen, and would walk in and would say, okay, this is the way the experiment is going to be performed. We're testing the tolerance of this human being to see how much electrical shock they can actually tolerate. And the test subject would listen and nod, and they would say, okay, so I want you to go ahead and administer the first shock, please. Please hit number one. And they would hit it, and then, you know, the Confederate would go, ow, 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 you know, and they would react. And then, you know, they would look over at the authority figure, and they would say, it's okay, don't worry about it. You know, we take full responsibility for this. Please, you know, carry on with the experiment. We understand that it was painful for that person, but it's okay. We accept all responsibility. Okay. This would go on up until the point that it was quite clear that the next shock would actually kill what the real test subject believed was the test subject. By the way, this is the kind of trickery that psychological experimentation has to perform. This is why it's sometimes tricky to describe psychological experiments, because there's all this deception going on, because you can't let someone know that they're being tested for a particular type of behavior, because that's going to change their behavior, right? So they would get up to this point, and then almost all of the test subjects, when told to administer the lethal shock, would do so when told by the authority figure that they absolutely had to carry on with the experiment, and that the authority figure would take all responsibility, would accept all responsibility for any damage performed. This is two out of three of the test subjects would actually administer the lethal shock. Now, this is something, when I first heard about this, I kind of had to like sit down for a minute and really think deeply. I found it extremely disturbing. But I realized later on in life that this particular phenomenon is something that affects all of us. By the way, to hearken back to our discussions about beliefs and the ideas that people put into our minds, it is often these authority figures that put these ideas into our minds, the ones that limit our beliefs. You can use this in marketing, and I'm praying that everyone listening is going to use it in an ethical way. You can use this in your marketing to enhance the impact of your marketing by using authority figures. So let's talk about how to use this ethically and how one could use it unethically, right? An unethical way of using it would be to, you know, have fake doctors up there, you know, endorsing fake medicines. This is actually something that I've seen happen on the internet. It's disgusting, right? I mean, you're actually harming people's lives. A really healthy way to use this would be when you're selling a really valuable, good product, to, you know, have authority figures there, real authority figures with, you know, real credentials endorsing those products. The act of doing that will greatly increase the response of all of your marketing efforts.
So an example of that would be, say, for instance, Tiger Woods using some sort of, I don't know, a golf club made by a certain manufacturer, or wearing Nike shoes.
That's right. Like that. Yeah. Now, a bad way would be Tiger Woods being an authority figure to comment on fidelity now, you know?
right.
After his recent shenanigans, right?
But yeah, totally
right. You know, Tiger Woods, I mean, look, I tend to want to forgive the guy. Look, he made some huge mistakes, but I mean, he's got, you know, unflinching credentials in the field of golf, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, for some people out there, Tiger Woods might not be a good example. Maybe you wanted me to say Roger Federer for tennis rackets. I think you get the point, though.
Yeah, if you object to Tiger Woods, you know, morality, then you certainly wouldn't want to use him.
Right. Well, I want to say a big thank you for being on the call today. You've spent a lot of time, like, covering a lot of valuable information about wealth, personal productivity, and the mindset that you need to make your dreams come true. Now, you've got a free product, one that you've spent, am I right in saying you've spent now hundreds of thousands of dollars on, that helps people get more out of their days and more out of their lives? I mean, I'm talking about Simpleologysite.com.
Yeah. Oh, well, millions actually in the development of everything there at this point. You know, now it's about 4 years into it. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've spared no expense to make this a really great resource for people.
Right. So would you mind telling people all about Simpleologysite.com?
I'm going to do that. Before I do that, I just want to say one thing to everyone listening. Guys, Mark Ling is a rare guy, and I want to encourage you guys to keep listening to what this guy has to say. You probably already know this because you've had enough interaction with him to know. But, you know, I'm someone that has some pretty high standards, and I'm not easily impressed. Mark has a standard of excellence that he always lives up to, and he's unfailingly ethical and honest in the way he deals with people. So I just want to make sure that you realize that you're with sort of a rare bird here, and I want you to really stick with the plan that he's outlined for you. Now, with that said,
Mark. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. I didn't want to leave an embarrassing pause there, but yeah. So with that said, Simpleology, it's a Web 2.0 system that people can use to manage their lives. And to put it really simply, you know, it simplifies the complicated life that we're all, you know, forced to deal with right now. And the end result that people get is that they're able to accomplish within 2 to 4 hours what normally takes them a day or sometimes even a week. And that sounds like a really outrageous claim, but I mean, you can go, once you get in there and you set up your account, we have a success stories board, and you can see the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people from around the world who are corroborating that result for you. And everything that we've spoken about earlier today, Simpleology is a system for automating that process so that you don't have to think too deeply about it. It automatically nudges you in the right direction so that the things that we talked about tonight are actually on a systematic level. They become your habitual process.
And just because you've got an American accent and I've got a Kiwi accent, would you mind spelling out that website for people?
I was going to say that earlier, but I didn't want to. Right, yeah. So for all of the Yanks listening, all of the Americans, Simpleologysite.com, that's Simpleologysite.com. simpleology.com, simpleologysite.com.
Yeah, and like I just want to reiterate, it's free, so there's no catch. It is free and it's fantastic. It's the kind of thing that other people would have charged a lot of money for, and you should take advantage of it and check it out as soon as you can. I just want to say another big thank you, Mark, for taking the time to be on the call. I really enjoyed it, and I've learned a lot, and I hope that people on this call have gained great value.
Likewise. Always a pleasure, Mark.
And for everyone else out there listening, take action with what you've learned, and we'll see you next time. Bye, guys.